You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom.
Hello, Robert Wright.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. Although that may bode ill for our conversation. As you pointed out, our best conversations are when you're tetchy, as you put it. But let me introduce this. Wait. Let's don't have an argument about whether you're tetchy. Save the arguments. You're Paul Bloom, famous Canadian psychologist. By the way, my condolences about Game 7 of the World Series. I'm sure your entire nation is in mourning. I do want to talk about it a little later because it's like the most amazing Game 7 of a series ever, probably.
I want to talk about that now.
And I want to say the Blue Jays have an unusual number of reasons to consider themselves just robbed by fate.
I appreciate that.
It's unbelievable. I want to talk about this. I've never seen anything quite like this. Okay. Yeah. But we'll get into that because there's other shit going on in this crazy world of ours. Is there an AI bubble that's about to burst? The market was a little jittery this morning. Oh, also there's this interesting New York mayoral election today, but maybe the biggest single thing we'll talk about, I don't know, is the gatekeeper question raised most recently by the controversial appearance of Nick Fuentes on Tucker Carlson's show. Michelle Goldberg wrote a whole piece about this in the New York Times. And it's interesting for a lot of reasons that I can get to. One of which is that I think I'm actually more pro-gatekeeper than you are in principle. And this may... this may challenge that. This particular example may force rethinking. I don't know. But what do you think about all this? Did you know who Nick Fuentes was before?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, anti-Semite, racist, proud of it. Not a sort of subtle judgment call with dog whistles and interpretation, but really quite open.
He's not subtle. No, Michelle quotes him. Let me just, if people don't, and you know, I barely knew before the Charlie Kirk thing. I just thought him as a fringe right wing figure, and then people started saying, well, some people are saying the Nick Fuentes people were behind the assassination, which it turns out to be
the Groupers.
No plausible. Yeah, the Groupers. That seems implausible, but that got my attention. So I went and looked at some of the things they said, and I said, pretty extreme. Anyway, Michelle summarizes his extremism with this quote. Quote, Jews are running society. Women need to shut up. Blacks need to be imprisoned for the most part. These are Nick Fuentes' quotes. I think more or less consecutively.
Yeah.
And I actually listened to the Tucker thing, or at least, well, the first half of it, it's pretty long. Anyway, this is apparently controversial within conservative circles as to whether, you know, Fuentes should be denounced or Tucker Carlson should be denounced for having him on his show, or whether Tucker Carlson is even within the gates to begin with. That's what's interesting to this about me is like, there are people who don't think Tucker should get into the gate. So if he cozies up to Nick Fuentes, like, what is that? Is that somebody being let through the gates, or is that like a new ecosystem outside of the gates, or just are there no gates, Paul? Are we living in a world without gates?
A world without gates. Mm-hmm. Very Thomas Friedman here. It's the title of your next book.
Yeah, it's
the world is gateless. To take these out of order, Tucker is definitely within the fold. You will hear it here first. I see him as a Republican nominee at some point. He is a man of extraordinary gifts.
I'm sure
I've told you this before, but I was watching the Republican National Convention where Trump was coronated. Everybody gives their speeches and they're reading a teleprompter and Tucker Carlson comes up and you never know, maybe there is some sort of teleprompter somewhere, but he's riffing. And he's talking twice as fast as everybody else. And he's funny. And he's profane. He's on a different level. He has gifts.
Yeah, but he has a lot of videotape that he could regret if he ever runs for political office, even as a MAGA Republican. Kind exactly that Fuentes has, even for example, where, I don't know, you tell me, is this not a problem for any MAGA Republicans? When he says, I was attacked by demons last night, here are the scratches on my arms, even though he by his own account, there are like big dogs in his bedroom all night. And
he said, that's the one that bothers you? He was attacked by demons?
Lot of weird shit like that.
Well, the attack by demons is not going to hurt him. A lot of the country is religious, Bob. And this sort of liberalism here, it's not a sort of turnoff for you liberal elites in Princeton.
We're getting kind of personal here.
I'm shifting register here. I will kind of bounce back with some agreement, which is that I'm a big free speech guy. But of course, you know, you have gatekeepers in the sense that you don't let, you get to choose who to profile and who to interview. And who to bring to public prominence. Newspapers make the choices. Podcasts make the choices. And there are some immoral choices. You know, bring a softball interview with Fuentes is grossly immoral, and I'm against it. I don't think they should be arrested. I mean, I'm a free speech guy, but I could say it's immoral and stupid and wrong. The Republicans should not be doing this. And people, I read Goldberg's article. You know, the Heritage Foundation shouldn't have responded with, no enemies to the right of us. That's the wrong response.
Yeah, as Michelle notes, I didn't realize this has become an actual acronym in some parts of MAGA, like NETTR, no enemies to the right, meaning, no, you just can't point at a guy like Nick Fuentes and say he's too far right. You're not allowed to say that. Now, the Heritage guy backtracked and said, I denounce, in the sense of saying, in denouncing Fuentes himself, but he didn't back off of the I'm not going to denounce Tucker for having Fuentes on kind of stance. Do you believe in Gates? I mean, you didn't use the word Gates there. Like, you do.
Of course I believe in gatekeeping.
Fuentes be beyond the gate?
Yeah. I think he should have every right to publish what he wants and say what he wants, but I don't think somebody with the audience that Tucker Carlson has should be interviewing him, giving a softball interview.
But now Tucker is not outside the gate, you're saying. Because there's definitely people still working on making him, you know, considered outside the gates.
There's sort of, as philosophers say, there's normative questions about the way things should be and descriptive questions about the way things are. I think Donald Trump should be outside the gate. I think that people should not be profiling Donald Trump or paying him much attention. But nonetheless, people seem to have elected him president. So I feel the same way with Tucker Carlson, which is, I think his views, you know, there's some really nasty views he has.
What's a nasty one?
I've heard him push. I'm going to be careful here because I don't have quotes at my fingertips. Mm-hmm. But I've heard him push what seemed to me to be ways of capturing white anxiety about foreign takeover that seemed to be quite ugly and racist.
Yep.
And I think this just appeals to people's worst parts of people's nature.
Yeah.
And by the way, is not going to kill him politically.
No. Well, no. I think he would do well in the nomination. Yeah, process. I still don't think he could get the nomination. Although, look. Shit could get even weirder than it is now. I think you're right. I mean, he uses the word replacement, and then I guess his defenders try to make a fine line between what he's saying and replacement theory and this and that. And he's very conspiratorially minded, and I think genuinely so. Like, he tried to convince, like, when Fuentes said there had been an assassination attempt on him, which Tucker knew. And by the way, I don't know, some people you just call them by their first name, even though you never met them, like Dario Amodei of Anthropic. He's Dario. Tucker's Tucker. Never met either of them, but whatever.
It's complicated. It's not a distinct first name because Noam Chomsky is always Chomsky, not Noam.
Well, Noam is a more distinct, is a less distinctive first name than Tucker or Dario. I know several Noams. Some of my best friends are named Noam, Paul.
Really?
Yeah.
Lingua Franca had a profile of Chomsky, which had a wonderful title, Gnome is an Island. Anyway, I know quite a few Tuckers, though.
Personally?
Not personally, but from fiction.
Okay, so anyway, where were we? So, where were we?
So we don't really disagree with this. I find the public elevation of a guy like Fuentes shocking and awful. But I have a question for you. As a critic of Israel, mm-hmm. do you think what I don't know how to process is that Republicans in my recent memory have been very pro-Israel and very, you know, not anti-Semitic mm-hmm. in any way, very pro-Israel. They get Israel support. This is a big part of things. Is this the sort of contingency that could just flip? And then, you know, a few years from now, we get a Republican who's extremely against Israel.
I want to back into that, but gets us back to the New York mayoral race. I guess a lot of people wouldn't have predicted that somebody who said the things Mamdani has said about Israel would be
Mayor. Democrat who's highly against Israel.
Right, but you would have thought New York City, no party at all. You know, of course, this is before October 7th and a lot of stuff happened, but it's still pretty surprising to me. But we can get back to that. Let me back into, I will answer your question. First, I want to quickly say the thing you said, of course, he should be able to publish and do what he wants. But yeah, I think he should be outside the gates. In the technological landscape of 30, 40, 50 years ago, you could say that.
Yeah.
That made more sense. Because now, if they can publish, you can't keep them out of the game. Another, if they can start their own podcast. Fuentes is a perfect example. He just, you know, he gave his story to Tucker about how he rose to prominence beginning at age 18. And it's all like, you know, YouTube and just, you know, stuff like that. And so, and this is the reason, I think the fundamental reason, there arguably are not gatekeepers in the sense that there used to be. And the distinction you're making, like, yes, should be able to publish, no, shouldn't be within the gates, is increasingly like not a makeable distinction. You know what I mean?
Fair enough. But there's a lot of people I think would want to be interviewed by Tucker Carlson or Joe Rogan.
Well, Rogan's a different case to me.
What do you mean?
Tucker's just more out there politically, certainly on Israel. And I guess this leads us to your, I mean, like, you know, if like when my book comes out, if I had a chance to be on Joe Rogan, I'd be like, I will pay for the flight. I'll walk to Austin if you'd like, you know, whatever. Whereas Tucker, like, I'd be like, not that he would care about this kind of book, but be a tougher call, because he can bring you a lot of publicity, and God knows that our integrity is at its lowest point when we have a book coming out. You've been there, right, Paul?
Oh, I can tell you stories. So let's play it. We'll take a little break. Let's play it. I will throw a podcaster out, and you tell me whether you'll appear on our show or not. Tucker Carlson.
Like I said, I'd have to pay attention to what he'd been saying in the most recent few months. I will later give you what my reservations about him are more specifically, but go ahead.
Assuming he gets better, Jordan Peterson.
Oh, yeah. I think of him as relatively innocuous anyway. I don't think he's, maybe it's just that the issues, maybe this is it, that the issues Tucker is out there on are more like issues that I myself am a little extended on, you know? And so I feel like association with him would be, like you said, Israel. I criticize Israel.
Yeah.
Not the way he does.
No.
And then he doesn't do it the way Fuentes does it. And I want to get back to this because from Tucker's point of view, that's what a lot of this conversation was about. Framing him with respect to Fuentes and also trying to moderate Fuentes. It turned Fuentes into somebody he could actually embrace. It's a kind of an arm's length interview to some extent. Yeah. And he wants Fuentes to like quit talking about the Jews. We can get back to what he means. But anyway, that's kind of the context of all that. Jordan Peterson, I don't know. Does it not make sense to you that to just think, well, no, Tucker's more toxic than Jordan Peterson?
No, that makes sense to me.
Okay.
That makes sense to me. I know some people wouldn't appear on Jordan Peterson's show because of his views on different things.
Yeah.
I find him, I've heard some of his interviews, and I find that they are would be difficult to be an interviewee. Not because the questions are particularly probing and challenging, but because a lot of it is sort of profiling, putting Peterson's own views in weird ways.
Mm-hmm.
But by the way, here's another roundabout way of getting at it. I have a Substack. By the way, Small Potatoes. We missed the whole introduction.
Oh, did you even mention?
Yeah. You didn't even self-promote.
I was so interested in getting the World Series because I thought that would be your central concern, and I am above all concerned about addressing your concerns, Paul. And so I forgot. I'm sorry. Small Potatoes, one of the best newsletters named Small Potatoes on all of Substack, I would say. I don't know, Paul. Maybe I'm being too generous. Would you agree? One of the best?
One of the best. One of the top four. And you are part of the Non-Zero Extended Universe.
Yes. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. See, I forgot that too, right?
I know. So it's not
That's
just...
That's what
just,
a selfless you know, person I am. It's all about you.
Anyway, on my Small Potatoes, I have the most recent post I was on called Five Recommendations, and I recommend Ross Douthat's excellent podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And we could talk about that. Mm-hmm. I think he's an excellent interviewer. I think he gets great guests. And so I say this, and somebody responds and says, no, he gets guests like J.D. Vance and Steve Bannon, and he shouldn't be profiling these people. Now, put aside Matt, take Bannon. I strongly disagree. But I find the kind of concern reasonable enough.
Mm-hmm.
If it was different, if it was Nick Fuentes, I'd say, no, Ross Douthat with his enormous podcast, with his enormous reach, should not be giving Nick Fuentes a voice. So there's judgment calls, and you and I may draw the line at different parts, but I do think there's a line to be drawn.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who the most out there guy Ross has had on is.
He had this very religious preacher guy who called trans people a very rude word and mm-hmm. It's not particularly nice about homosexuals. But this guy is so fringy I never heard of him before, that it's more of a sort of anthropological, look what those wackos believe.
Yeah, no, I've never seen a Ross Douthat podcast in my feed where I thought, I can't believe he's talking to this person.
Yeah.
I have occasionally been frustrated that he wasn't grilling the person more. I mean, he is, the great thing about Ross as a columnist for the New York Times is I think he kind of understands MAGA world, sometimes in a sympathetic way, sometimes not. But, you know, he's from the strand of conservative that conservatism has a closer affinity with MAGA world than, say, the libertarians or something. And he just kind of gets it. And so he can bring these people on. And I think there's value in showing that the ones who aren't crazy aren't crazy. Now, he also has some people on that I think maybe could be grilled in ways he doesn't, but he's pretty aggressive. It's definitely a great podcast.
I like his style. For one thing, because he's conservative and believes in God and takes religion seriously and takes mm-hmm. MAGA concerns seriously, he's able to draw people out in a way that some NPR interviewer wouldn't. And then he draws them out, and often they say incredible things. And he kind of almost lulls them. I don't think intentionally, but he gets people to say surprising things.
Mm-hmm.
Not just conservative sort of thing. I'm sure you've heard this with Peter Thiel.
Yeah, where he says...
Where he basically gets him to say, you know, so the extermination of the human race would, of course, be a bad thing. And Thiel's saying, well...
Let me do the math. Give me a second.
You have to listen to the pause. You got to appreciate the pause.
It's a long pause. Now, Thiel finally does say
yes.
What you would hope.
He says, he reluctantly says yes. But, you know, he's talking, Thiel's talking about the Antichrist. And Douthat's the kind of guy who takes the idea of Antichrist seriously.
Yeah.
And that makes it for a better discussion.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one thing Tucker Carlson shares with a number of his guests, including Nick Fuentes. But you know, here's something I heard Fuentes say. It's funny. You know, Tucker kind of wants to, I think, launder the guy a little. It's funny. I think he's trying to do these two things that are in tension. He's kind of trying to launder him a little or moderate him enough to make him more presentable. But he's also distinguishing himself from him. He keeps saying, look, you know, because, so here's the thing. Tucker, what he gets in trouble for is not just criticism of Israel, but talking about the influence of the Israel lobby, broadly construed, the speech police, and so on. That's the closest thing to a no-go zone now that it's no longer bad to use the words apartheid or even, I mean, it's no longer socially unacceptable to call it genocide, although there's a lot of controversy about that. But anyway, a lot of the lines have been crossed in that kind of speech code, but the best way to get into trouble is to talk a lot about the influence of pro-Israel people. And Tucker does a lot of that, and that's one reason he still takes a lot of heat. And there's definitely people who want him on the other side of the gate, right? The ADL and a lot of people. And so Nick Fuentes is another person who talks about that. And there's a growing number of conservatives who are annoyed because of the pressure they've felt from the speech police. One of them is Megyn Kelly. Mm-hmm. One of them was starting to be Charlie Kirk, hence some of the conspiracy theories. But when Fuentes does it, he's like, the problem is the Jews. I mean, maybe he hasn't uttered that sentence, but Tucker says the sensible thing. First of all, there are non-Jews who are very influential in enforcing, you know, a pro-Israel code. Rupert Murdoch, if you look at Fox News, the Wall Street Journal editorial page. And then, as Tucker says, there are anti-Zionist Jews, there are Jews who criticize Israel, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. All true. But Fuentes, you know, keeps saying, no, we got to talk about the Jewish neocons, you know, as if
you can imagine that the people really most worried about Fuentes would be people like you. You know, you're a powerful critic of Israel, but you quite reasonably say that is not in any way equivalent to anti-Semitism. And to make things complicated, though, there are people whose hatred of Israel stems from anti-Semitism, like Fuentes. And so he's the first person somebody, a good critic of Israel, would want to sort of repudiate.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what his position originally stems from, but yeah, he says these things that sound anti-Semitic.
Not a friend of the chosen
people. The story he tells is that, you know, he doesn't come from an educated family. His parents didn't go to college. He's like a freshman at Boston University. And by his account, he's like curious. He's like, and he starts asking questions about Israel, and pressure gets applied from, well, wait, is it Ben Shapiro or is some right-wing guy? I think maybe it is. Yeah, I think it is. And so he chafes at that. That's his account, is that when people tried to shut him down, he got pissed off. And by his account, I guess the most influential shutter downers are Jewish or something. But I know what I was, wait, I just want to throw this. I don't think I said this. I'm sorry. I didn't get my sleep last night. A lot of tangents here. I was talking about how, you know, Tucker, you know, he wants Fuentes to sound user friendly enough for people to keep listening. So he's not asking him the super challenging questions. Fuentes is sounding like this reasonable guy. And then all of a sudden he says something that got my attention. He says, you know, people say that the Republican Party is like that. People think the Republican Party is like all conservatives, but it's not. There's atheists. There's gay people. And I thought, whoa, like many people don't think that these are mutually exclusive categories, right? Like you could be a gay conservative. You could be an atheist conservative. In a way, that's as hardcore. I mean, that's like very substantively hardcore. But then you realize
the things that you quoted about what he said about black people and about women, that's kind of hardcore.
That's hardcore, yeah. But in a flat out bigot, that's like bigotry. This is like a whole conception of conservatism that is like, whoa, I didn't quite grasp that. And I wonder, well, Tucker didn't push back. I don't think he would have.
But let me push back. I mean, of all the sins, it seems there's a perfectly coherent notion of conservative that would be incompatible with being gay. It's one grounded in religion and tradition.
Oh, and, sure. And the one that prevailed 60 years ago. It's just surprising to hear it now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, of all the things that, that Trump has done, he's effectively severed the Republican Party from any coherent notion of conservative.
Yeah.
You said you were reading the Buckley biography, and we're going to
by Sam Tannenhouse. It's really masterful, I think. I mean, it's so refreshing now that more and more things are like called books to see just this huge tome that was painstakingly put together and is beautifully written. And I've learned a lot. I mean, and one thing I did not appreciate is the extent to which William F. Buckley is a precursor of MAGA. The tactics, the ideology. Now, he did... originally he was ideologically, I would say, quite close to that zone. He did, in the course of trying to make conservatism more mainstream, at least one bridge. He became an ultra hawk on foreign policy, which was not consistent with his origins, I would say, ideologically. He also is famous. Michelle Goldberg mentions this in the column. For expelling the anti-Semites from the Conservative Party.
The John Birch Society, yeah. I remember.
Yeah. And I will say, Buckley's best friend, one of his best friends in college, I mean, I know it sounds funny, some of my best friends anyway, for what it's worth, one of his best friends at Yale was Jewish, but the funny thing is Buckley's father was so anti-Semitic that when this best friend fell in love with Buckley's sister, father just said, no fucking way. Yeah. And it was William F. Buckley's job to explain to this guy, you know, I have bad news, but you're Jewish and you can't marry my sister. It wasn't William F. Buckley saying that, but like, that was the deal. So anyway, but if you look at the tactics and the very ideology, mm-hmm. I mean, it was, if you're, I mean, of course, Buckley's first famous book is God and Man at Yale, which is a complaint about the secularness and you know, of Yale and the lack of support for Christianity specifically. I mean, mm-hmm. he is a hardcore Christian conservative. There are things he wrote in National Review early on that sound pretty damn racist about blacks. But just the tactic, the demonizing of these elites who don't care about you. I mean, he's like a populist rabble rouser who originally has a lot in common.
I'm not a Buckley guy, but I'm struggling with this because my impression of Buckley, what's the word, patrician? That's the right word. Anyway.
He
comes off as extremely educated, mm-hmm. rather snooty, mm-hmm. well, you know, authoritative, rich. Mm-hmm. He doesn't go sort of a populist man at a people kind of guy.
Yeah, you don't imagine that, but... That was the vibe he was. That was his first successful kind of modus operandi was to, and you're right. Okay, so Patricia went to Yale, went to prep school, grew up in Northern Connecticut, I think, and his father had made money in the oil, but it turns out his father seems to have been involved in some pretty shady shit, so was JFK's father, but... And that accent, I don't know. Well, Buckley's accent, our younger viewers may have no idea who, I don't know. William F. Buckley is a very important figure in bringing conservatism. First of all, you had to bring it to the center of the Republican Party because the Republican Party had been kind of Eisenhower moderate. So he did that, and he started National Review and blah, blah, blah. But he had this famously elite-sounding accent, which, according to Sam, which, according to his book, Buckley said was a product of him having growing up in this weird multilingual environment. He learned Spanish before English, apparently.
And he was famous for using, like, large words which is easily satirized and mocked.
Yeah.
But hardly, you know, not really a Joe Sixpack kind of guy.
No, in fact, one more anecdote from the biography. It's weird how there are these little things that really drive me crazy that most people say, what are you upset about? But I found this almost offensive. So he, you know, sailing and skiing were two big things. Like, he had a yacht.
Yeah.
And they would sail around, and sometimes, like, they'd say, hey, we could use some lobster. So they would take lobsters, like, out of the lobster traps that the lobster fishermen had set, and as recompense, they would put a bottle of, like, I think it was Johnny Walker Scotch or something. And I just, so most people would say, great deal, right? But to me, that is just so condescending and patronizing. It's like, no, Bill, the first principle is, if you're a conservative, you fucking respect their property, A, and B, you know, you're let them eat cake, deposit of your fucking bottle of, I'm sorry. But anyway, isn't that offensive?
It is like a parody. It's like sort of Animal House parody when you get the preppy kids. This is exactly what they would do.
Right.
They would take the lobster from the hardworking lobster men.
Right.
And put some, these men will like some of our fine scotch.
Right.
We'll put it there.
Right. Now, I think they wanted a lobster, Bill.
Okay. But we have this is going very well considering. But I wanted to
considering who we are, considering who I am, what? Elaborate.
You had a poor night's sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just being I'm on the top of my game. But I got a lot of sleep.
We'll let the commenters weigh in on that.
Yeah, fair enough. The YouTube commenters will tell a story. But I want to double back. Mm-hmm. I could easily imagine a Democratic presidential nominee and a Democratic president who despises it. Who thinks Israel has committed genocide is wants this in, and there may be enough support in the Democratic Party for that person to win a nomination. Maybe it's enough support in the country for that person to become president. Do you see that in the next few years from the Republican Party?
I mean, first of all, traditionally that has been undoable. It's there could not have been such a president in the past. I think. I mean, because you know, I mean the. Both parties, I would say, had political reasons not to go there, strong ones. Barack Obama, it was only, I think they actually mentioned this, Tucker maybe mentioned this, but I knew it. It was only when Barack Obama was a lame duck after the final election, when he abstained, when the U.S. abstained from a UN Security Council vote that meant calling something Israel did a violation of international law. Obama would have loved to do that forever, but probably ideologically, but he didn't dare so long as he was going to face a re-election or even the Democrats were going to face an election. Yeah. I mean, he didn't do it anytime during his second term when he wasn't going to face a re-election until after the last election. But it's, I don't want to do a whole dissection of the pro-Israel forces that impinge on politicians. A new and interesting question is which party is that more likely, right? That's traditionally it's been impossible in both. You are seeing stronger criticism that's considered acceptable of Israel in both parties. But I don't know. What's your scenario? How does this happen? Well, what's your answer? Is it more likely to be a Republican president in your scenario or a Democratic one? I mean, I don't think we're going to see either in my lifetime, but...
It's much more likely to be a Democratic president for reasons I gave. But I don't find it impossible to be a Republican president. I think we learned a lot from what Trump has been doing, where... All of a sudden, you know, Trump becomes president and you have liberals cheering on the FBI and CIA and the Republicans hating them. You have all of a sudden this total flip in what people think about Putin, where the liberals think Russia's our fated enemy. And the Republicans think that Putin is this you know, guy, powerful guy we should respect. Here's a trivia question, Bob, that I'm sure you will answer. Who was it who said, fuck the Jews, they didn't vote for us anyway?
Somebody in the George H.W. Bush administration, was it James Baker?
You got it. Good work. We don't do these things ahead of time. You just spring on these quizzes.
No, it's just Paul is still trying to stump me.
But no, you did well. But so within the Republican Party, there is an acknowledgement that, that, you know, maybe less so than it used to be, that Jews don't vote for him. And I could just see it. I could see next week Trump, for some reason, Netanyahu fails to kiss his ass sufficiently, mm-hmm. or Netanyahu's out, and then they get some guy who, for some reason, Trump doesn't like, and all of a sudden Trump says, Israel, we're going to have to show him a thing or two. And well, I can just see the party moving lockstep with Trump.
If Trump indeed thinks this is his last term, which I hope he does, you could see a lot of things. He's a wild card. I think so long as he was running for re-election, he was going to be, and he basically said this, he was going to be mindful of the pro-Israel donors. He mentioned the Adelsons. He talked about how Miriam Adelson used to come in the Oval Office and he'd recite the things he had done for Israel, and she would want even more. I mean, and both parties have that part of the donor base, you know, and what James Baker said is a lot has become somewhat less true, I think. I mean, certainly before Trump, I think there had been some migration of American Jewish voters, older ones probably, to the Republicans. But the number of Jewish voters isn't the big thing anyway. There aren't that many of them, unless you're in New York or something, 3%. You know. But
I think there are more Muslim voters.
Probably close. I'm not sure quite, but yeah, it's both like what, a couple of percentage points?
Yeah. From a numbers standpoint, not much.
Yeah, no. So voter-wise, and this is one reason I'm skeptical of your claim.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. More Jews.
Yeah, somewhat. But, you know, it's not a huge difference at those levels. But voter-wise, the Republicans do have evangelicals who are nominally pro-Israel. I don't know how heartfelt it is for how many of them. But that's why when you say it's going to happen in the Republican Party, I don't know. In terms of actual number of pro-Israel voters that they worry about, I would guess there's more on the Republican side now than the Democrats.
Maybe I get to see it happening in the Democratic Party. Just AOC or Mamdani or whatever comes to nominee. Odds of AOC becoming nominee are not zero.
I think they both got a tough road to hoe to get there, and an even tougher one to get elected. But I want to say one thing quickly: is that the irony? I think it's kind of ironic that in the wake of October 7th, all of this right-wing firepower has been focused on shutting down harsh criticism of Israel by labeling it anti-Semitic. And I'm sure some of the things they labeled anti-Semitic were actually anti-Semitic, but I don't think that was like the main motivation, and I don't think it was usually true. But the irony I see is I think on the right, there is probably a more organic connection and like a blurrier line between harsh criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism. And I think the kind of, like, if you look at things Tucker Carlson says and things that Nick Fuentes says, you kind of see what I mean. If you just look at Nick Fuentes, you see what I mean. I mean, who on the left is like Nick Fuentes? Really, honestly, who of these well-known Israel critics on the left are going around saying the problem is the Jews, right? Nobody you've heard of.
I'm a why not both kind of guy. I think you're right about the sort of organic nature of anti-Semitism on the right. And I also think maybe it's going to take roots in the Republican Party in a particularly vivid way. But I see it on the left. I think the root to it on the left is a lot of people on the left, and a lot of Jews on the left, see the Palestinians as sort of akin to blacks in America. They're dark-skinned people. And the Jews in Israel are light-skinned colonial oppressors. And sometimes they'll literally say that. Now, I think this is a gross oversimplification, but a lot of this is how the Middle East is framed. And if you frame it this way, with the Palestinians being the good guys and the Israelis being the bad guys, it's not a big jump to think of the Jews as, well, yet more white.
No, people. I think it's a bigger jump because, first of all, we could talk about how much of it is about the skin tone. I mean, I would note that, like in Ireland, Catholics identified with Palestinians, and Catholics, last time I checked, looked about as white as the Protestants in Ireland, but Catholics identified with the Palestinians, and they didn't have a whole empire narrative and, you know, settler colonialism narrative. It was just like they saw them as the oppressed people, and they saw themselves as the oppressed people. Yeah. And I do think you shouldn't give short shrift to the part of the left-wing narrative that is about sheer oppression. But I would also say, to the extent that it is about white skin, well, how's that anti-Semitism? I mean, in that critique, American Caucasians are oppressing people of color in various countries, and it's the same thing as Israelis of lighter skin tone oppressing Palestinians in that frame, right? It's an imperialist and it's funny. I was just talking to Danny Besner and Derek Davison, who are left of me, and they do the American Prestige podcast every couple of months. I talk to them about the fact that, you know, the people on the left don't go on and on about the Israel lobby and that the influence brought to bear on American politicians the way people do on the right. They just don't. I mean, I think there's a respectable version of it that they should do more, but they don't. And that is the thing that's the impulse that leads Nick Fuentes to where he goes. And I think the frame you just described, white oppressors of dark-skinned people, is not amenable to an anti-Semitic, per se, reading, you know, by its nature, right?
Well, you're saying it's not amenable because if so, it would apply to ourselves. It would apply to...
It does. On the left, it does. It applies to white males.
So that's my point. Jews are the villains because they're yet more white people. They are more white people who are particularly showing all of these terrible white attributes and inflicting them upon the oppressed dark-skinned people of Palestine.
I don't know, man. I mean, the framing to me sounds like anti-white people. With the exclusion of the people doing the critiquing, of course, many of whom are white. But
let me frame it in this way. From a certain sort of leftist standpoint, it's a lot easier to be anti-Jewish than anti-Muslim because the Jews are seen, and it's not exactly true. There's a lot of dark-skinned Israelis, but dark-skinned Jews. Jews are seen as whites, and so we inherit all the sins of white people. And then you just need a sort of extra secret sauce of ancient Jew hatred. Kind of get in there.
Okay, but again, I think that per se is more evident on the right. Look at what they cite. Look at what they, when they say this is anti-Semitic, do they say, oh, they talked about Jews in the media? No, they say they said from the river to the sea. That's what they're saying is anti-Semitic. And that's just a different trope. I mean, you can argue about whether it should be, but it's like a different trope. I mean, my own view is that they actually mean, most of the people saying that don't mean what Jews fear, and in some ways naturally fear, they mean.
Most of the people saying that don't mean anything. It's a chant.
But leave that aside. That's a different trope. That's not Nick Fuentes. I mean, Nick Fuentes, see, that's the thing. Nick Fuentes doesn't give a fuck about the Palestinians. You know, he doesn't. He doesn't. His whole thing is, I don't give a fuck about any Americans. And actually, come to think of it, I'm mainly concerned about white Christian Americans.
Yeah. Hey, in some way, this is, as we like to say, an empirical question. There's two questions, which is, one question is, how much is anti-Semitism taking root in the political party, in our major political parties? Mm-hmm. The second question is, you look at polling data. I'll do my homework. I'll come with this for next time we talk. You do your polling data and you say, people who identify as liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, what do you guys think of the Jews? And I honestly don't know. It's an empirical question.
There's more criticism of Israel on the left. Public opinion polling shows that, but you're right. They don't very often.
The Israel question sucks.
They don't. Nobody's come to my door and said, what do you think of the Jews? Yeah, it's not a common polling question.
It is there. There's a lot of social science research where you can get feeling thermometers, but the Jews, the blacks, the gays, the Irish, not the Irish. I just tossed that in.
Well, there was a time.
I know.
That's the interesting thing. It's like Fuentes. Wait a second. What kind of name is that? That doesn't sound British. Yeah. Like, You know, when did you become one of the chosen ones?
Only in America. Right? A guy named Fuentes. Right.
I mean, maybe he would say, well, these are European Spaniards, not, you know, Latin Americans. I don't know what his heritage is, but it's kind of ironic that, you know, he it really is a, it's amazing how overt he and to some extent Tucker are about, there's some sense in which it should be a white nation and a Christian nation, you know? Yeah.
That is, I think, the roots of the core roots of anti-Semitism on the right. A strong belief in the power of Christianity, seeing the Jews as aliens, as, you know, corrosive aliens, communists, venomous in some way.
I bet I could show you some Groypers who are secular anti-Semites, but maybe not a lot and maybe not prominent ones. I don't know.
Yes. I think the secular anti-Semites come more from the left.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the World Series.
Yeah, so we've been talking for 46 minutes. I really think it's time. I hate to bring down the
curtain. We're going
to
paywall our World Series discussion?
We can do a World Series tease. We'll do a couple of World Series teases. But before we do, we're about to go into overtime.
Yeah, okay.
Available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero Newsletter or a Small Potatoes Newsletter, the one that... Paul Bloom puts out. And here's the thing I think you really need to appreciate is that if you're a paid subscriber to either of our newsletters, you can get a one-year subscription, paid subscription, to the other one for 50% off. Paul, have I got that right? It's just, I can't believe what I'm hearing because it just seems too amazing and generous. I didn't get much sleep. Do I have the numbers wrong, Paul? Tell me.
It sounds insane.
It sounds crazy.
Yeah. We're just giving this away.
It's like, remember Crazy Eddie?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, you weren't around the New York area. Crazy Eddie. Well, anyway, this is crazy. And that's all I have to say. So anyway, if you go to the post for this at our place, Go Beyond Paywall, yeah, you'll see that link.
There have been posts
of yours already, and you will eventually, you always, God bless you, get around to doing a post about the podcast.
I always do.
You can put it beyond the paywall there, and there's posts where you've already put it beyond, like our last one, probably. Yeah. Good example.
So once you subscribe, you get to this thing where you click, and then you get to Bob's podcast and newsletter for pennies. It's like amazing.
Pennies on the dollar.
Yeah. It's a wonder how we stay in business. And the answer is volume.
We lose money on every purchase, but make it up in volume. So before the paywall descends, just a mind-blowing World Series Game 7. And I don't know if you are you a baseball fan? Probably not.
I am not, but my wife is a serious baseball fan. She's from Toronto. She got me into it. So I watched coming up to the playoffs. I watched them play the Mariners. I would watch the whole game. And then the World Series was amazing. And for the first time in my life, really, I got into a team. I followed them. I knew what each player's strengths and weaknesses. I knew their batting averages. And I was so into the game. And then Game 7 was, I think it was a wonderful game. It was one of the best, I'm told by people who've seen a lot of it, it was one of the best World Series games ever. And it was a heartbreaker.
Man, was it. I mean, it set a new record for heartbreaking. That's what I want to talk about. Okay. Yeah. And I hadn't been paying that much because I like to finish my book. I did this no sports policy. We cut the cord. There was no sports on TV for last year, but I did take out a 5-day free subscription to the streaming service Fubo trial subscription, which I've now canceled so I could watch the last two.
Thanks for admitting that. A lot of people don't admit that little cheap moves.
Oh, I've done it twice. Fubo, both times. Two trial subscriptions, one for the Super Bowl, one for the end of the World Series.
This podcast is sponsored by Fubo.
Fubo, F-U-B-O. Great service.
Great service.
Apparently an endless stream of free trial subscriptions. Okay, so we're going to paywall. Hope you'll either follow us or rate and review us.
What are we going to discuss past the pay? This is not so well.
But we are in overtime now, right?
No, I thought we were gonna, not yet. We gotta say,
well,
what we gotta
do. It's been 50 minutes. I mean, these people are asleep. It's like
we got to tease the topics of it. So we're going to talk about
topics. Okay, what are the other topics? I read a biography of Napoleon. Dick Cheney died.
What? I was going to talk about the great feminization, but that's a big enough topic we could save that for some other day.
Maybe. We'll see. I don't know. I'm starting to feel my oats. We could be at this for hours.
No,
what there's a bargain that subscription thing is.
Man. AI, the AI bubble.
Oh, yeah. Is there an AI bubble? I'll write that down. There's so much. I don't know. Yeah, we'll try to.
Let's go. Oh, and we should watch. Everybody should watch The Diplomat. Read Ian McEwan's recent novel.
Jesus, you're just like a plug machine. Are you getting a commission? Anyway, okay. Can we go into overtime now?
Let's go into overtime. Okay.
All right.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you. And we're in overtime.